I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Jo Derbyshire. Welcome, Jo.
Thank you.
It's lovely to see you here in the West End of Fremantle. I imagine this is a place you have frequented over the years.
I have. I've been very lucky to have several different stints of work in the West End. But I go back to my grandmother was actually born at Government House headquarters there on top of Arthur's Hill.
Yes.
Yeah, so...
Goodness.
That was amazing. So I do have a big connection.
Real connection with Fremantle. Mm. Going back to about when?
1895.
Gosh. Mm. So that means that in your DNA and more recently, people have been looking across Fremantle Harbour, out across Waddesdale Bathers Beach, watching boats come in.
Mm-hmm.
This probably explains why you've painted boats and things.
Well, who knows? I mean, on the other side of the family, I've also got a sea captain, John Ferguson, who had a ship here and lived in Arundel Street. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I like to call myself Fremantle royalty, but yeah, that's a bit of a joke. But I've also worked here. I've worked here in Old Customs House with AFWA from 1997 to 2000, and my job was to run the Moores Building.
The Moores Building, what another lovely.
It was a fantastic job. And yes. I loved working in this building, and having the history of the Old Customs House was amazing as well. And I think had, you know, a big impact on my work as well. As you say, looking out over the harbour, noticing the ships coming in and what kind of ships they were, and the whole romanticism of seafaring, I suppose.
When we first chatted just after the shipping news launched, it was about your observations of ships and their names coming into Fremantle. Amazing names these ships have.
Mm. Yeah, considering that they're often container ships, you know, bringing in dirty old cars or new cars. Yes, very, I love the names. I love the shipping names.
But you are an artist, and you have been for quite a while.
I have been. I have seemed to have survived as an artist for more than 40 years, which is incredible.
So did you always want to be an artist? I'd love to ask this sort of question.
Yeah. I lived in Lake Grace, which is a wheat belt town, when I was a kid. My father was the Shell service station agent there, and my mum was a primary school teacher. And when I was about 8 or 9, she came home with some oil paints that she was going to go to a class with. And I begged her to let me use them, and she sat for me for 2 hours, and I painted my first oil painting, and I absolutely loved it. And from that moment on, knew that that's what I wanted to do.
So you didn't start with coloured pencils or pastels
well,
or crayons?
I loved art as a kid, and you know, my aunties always gave me art materials and things like that. But it was that moment, I think, that I remember thinking, this is, and I didn't even know that there was such a thing as being an artist. No, there was no other artist in our family.
Well, I love what you do, the pieces I've seen, the ones I remember, but there's one that I discovered that I didn't know, mm-hmm. which is quite, to me, quite beautiful. I thought I was in an aquarium when I looked at it, and it made me feel good. What is that?
Okay, so that is a large work that I made. It's 1.8 metres high, and then 3 metres across.
My goodness.
It's a diptych. And I painted it during COVID, when we were all sort of locked down at home. But I used to go for a walk in Boomeyborough Park every day. And it was also when the golf course was open to locals. We could walk around the golf course. And all that was there was crows, thousands of crows. And also started noticing the fennel growing everywhere. And of course that fennel was brought in on the ships by the Sicilians and the Italians, and grows wild now as a kind of feral weed around Fremantle. But it's such an incredible plant. It's a very healing plant. And I started to look at the life cycle of the fennels, and I decided to do this great big painting about them. And it's sort of a metaphor, I guess, for life and death and the cycle of life, from the flowering of the fennel right to the end when you see the dead sticks sticking up with all the seeds on the top of them, and you can collect those seeds and crush them and put them in chocolate biscuits or cooking.
Chocolate biscuits or cooking?
Yeah.
Or in a painting?
Yeah.
So I'm fascinated about that germination, let's stick with it, process,
mm-hmm.
where you go walking, it's in a strange COVID time, you see the fennel, you see its relationship with things that have happened in Fremantle, like people mm-hmm. coming from Cupar Delando and bringing it with them. And then saying to yourself, or thinking to yourself, there's a painting here, and mm-hmm. starting to do something about that, and then coming up with something as big as this. In three pieces, did you say?
Two pieces. Look, this is the process of being an artist, of painting, is that you're really taught to focus and to look at the world. And so when you really look intently at something, you see all the facets of it, and you realise that life is exquisite, you know, and that there's many facets to things, and that they lead you on. And not only is it, because I love history and I love the history of Fremantle, not only is it kind of historical that this plant is here, but also visually, you know, I was entranced by the sort of Z growing, the way that the stems grew in a kind of Z pattern, a zigzag pattern. So once I noticed that and I started to take bits of dead stick home with me, I was thinking, well, I love this. How can I paint this to bring out that abstractness, but also to talk about, you know, the soft green of the new growth. The new growth is almost fluorescent green, which is interesting. And then when the plant is dead, you know, you have this kind of dry, beautiful beige-coloured sticks.
Well, when you started out, you knew you wanted to be an artist from being in Lake Grace and mm-hmm. getting hold of your mother's oil paints and starting daubing. Tell us about your formal training as an artist after that.
Well, you know, I come from a very middle-class family and none of us had gone to university. But I was encouraged by my grandparents and my aunts, and I had a very loving family. And at art school, I mean, at high school, you know, I did well in art and I had good art teachers, and they encouraged me to think about going to uni. But I didn't really know how to. And then one day I had this extraordinary serendipitous moment where I was down at the beach in Wembley Downs where we lived, and I started to talk to a woman that was sitting on the beach by herself. And I was only, you know, 17. And she asked me what I wanted to be, you know, when I left school, and I said an artist. And she said, oh, my brother is an artist, and I will get him to come and talk to you about it or to tell you about it. Anyway, her brother turned out to be Andrew Hayam de Vries, who is a very well-known East Fremantle, was a very well-known East Fremantle artist. And he just turned up at our house in Wembley Downs on a Friday afternoon. I was still in my school uniform, and he said, I'm here to take Joe to the graduate exhibition at Waite, which is now Curtin Art School. And he very kind, my mother agreed for me going off with this complete stranger. And so off I went, and he very kindly took me around the art school, the graduation show, and explained all his paintings, explained other people's paintings, and basically encouraged me to apply and how to get in. And it was, so I did. So the next year, the following year, I went to Curtin, I went to Waite, which is now Curtin, the fine arts school there. And that was 1978.
What a wonderful story, as you say, serendipity.
Serendipity has played a huge part in my life, and I'm so grateful that I met Andy.
And I like that thing. In a sense, it's passing the baton to the next generation. It's a very physical thing, and you might have thought you were just 17, but you suddenly think, I'm 17 and I'm ready to do all of this. This is exciting.
Yeah.
When you started that course at Waite, as it then was, did you think you were going to be a particular sort of artist? Did you think you were just going to paint portraits of your mother for the rest of your life? Did you think that you wanted to paint like Picasso? Did you have a concept of what you wanted to paint?
Not really. I sort of liked more representational work and thought that you could learn how to paint people and things like that. But what they did at art school in those days was far more radical. They kind of untaught you what you were taught at school, and they tried to get you to think more about what more interesting ways to paint or to have something to say to paint. And of course, it was really a boys' club, the whole art scene in Perth at that time. And at art school, we just sort of started having that burgeoning sense of feminism, which was questioning why there weren't more women artists. And I was very lucky to have some strong feminist older women that were in the course. And I look back now and think that they really influenced me in a way. But also the kindness of some of the my art lecturers influenced me. But I was very young, and I think probably it would have been better if I had a gap year. And after 3 years, I also did theatre arts at the same time.
Right.
So I was very involved in theatre as well. And then I went to live in Sydney, and I realised, you know, I had a long way to go as an artist, and I almost gave up at that point. I just thought, oh. But somehow I managed to keep painting in Sydney, and then came back to Western Australia, and just, you know, I don't think I was a very good painter when I was younger, but I had lots of things to say. I thought I did. And so I guess I just tried to make art and kept going.
The gender thing in creativity, the gender thing in everything, always interests me. I mean, as you say, I mean, apparently only men can be great poets, or only men can be great writers, or, you know, you could almost think that was the case when you were growing up. I'm sure everywhere, but Australia included, although in my own case, I think of all of the women painters, Judith Wright seemed the most prominent poet in my days. We got to know the Margaret Prestons of the world and many others. But did you discover, when you said it was a boys' world, that the boys thought of particular sorts of ways to paint, or did they have particular things to say that were quite different from what you think you wanted to say?
At that time, which was the late 70s and early 80s, abstract expressionism was very big here, and most of those practitioners were men and very celebrated, and so they should have been. And John Beard was someone that was painting then. And I think that as a young woman, I just couldn't compete. I couldn't identify with that. I didn't know how to... I just didn't feel like that as a young woman that was what I was interested in or could do. Now I think I'm really enjoying doing that kind of painting, and it seems right at the time for me to do that. But when I was younger, you know, I had a lot to say about feminism. I used text. I was part of Artemis, the women's art group here, which was about elevating women in the arts here in Perth and Fremantle, and did so, I think. Gave a lot of women a lot of confidence to keep on exhibiting and to do bigger work, or to do work they were interested in. But it was a harder time. I think having ARCS, the ARCS group of events that happened here in the 80s, that was very good. There was a lot of women involved in that from other countries and other states and New Zealand. And so I think that really changed the culture here as well.
Yeah, it's, in a sense, validates what you're doing. Was there for you some, bit like being tapped on the shoulder at the beach when you were 17, some moment when you discovered your style, when you knew exactly what it was that you wanted to do?
No, I haven't had a moment where I've discovered my style. I don't think I have a style. I've moved around a lot between styles. And I think our generation was encouraged to have the idea first and then think about, well, what is the best way to make work about this idea? That took me a long time to sort of work out, but I still have that. So, for instance, that fennel work that we're talking about, that's almost representational. The they really look like fennel plants.
Which is a little unusual for you.
Yeah, and that yet I have those abstract elements, and I also have what you would call the underwater experience, which was really a technique where you don't have a horizon line. You have this kind of open plane in the painting which lets people move back and forwards. So I've used a few techniques in that painting, you know, a few ideas. And really that was because the idea I wanted to get across about the fennel was quite complex. So, but I didn't sort of go, oh, I can't do that because everyone knows me for my underwater pictures or the abstract work I'm doing at the moment, which is very different to that fennel work. So I move around a lot between different styles, different techniques. But if you look, if I look back at the history of my work, it's always the idea is like a circle, circles back across itself and the artworks.
So I've always been interested in this other aspect of how political art is or can be. You'll think of Picasso's Guernica and war and terrible things that are happening. I've never forgotten. I happened to be in Sicily just after 9/11 and in Syracuse, walking down a narrow street, and I saw this most arresting painting. It would have been a couple of metres high and 1.5 metres wide. It was the Twin Towers. Somebody had painted the Twin Towers on fire. And I wanted to go in and interrogate whoever the artist was. I wanted to buy it. Oh, this is an astonishing thing in a moment of time. Another part of it made me feel very guilty of having that thought. This was in just the weeks after. Astonishing things. But I mean, is anything off limits for art? I mean, do you yourself want to send a message in what you paint?
When I was younger, I very much did. Yeah, I think I was very didactic with that message. Now I think I find it quite difficult to be political in my art. I'm very political in my life, as you know, as an activist or you know, on social media, or I'm very anti-war and I always have been. But I don't know whether for me, it doesn't seem to work to make art about those issues. Although about 4 years ago, I made a large submarine out of books. I don't know if you remember that. That's probably my most political work, but all of those books were thrown out by the Defence Force Officers Library in Perth. And I rescued almost 2,000 books, and I made this submarine using their book covers. And all of the book covers have titles that, you know, I was a Stuka pilot, or and very negative about war, and all of those books written by ordinary people who their message was, don't go to war again. And it was very, very metaphorical to me that they had thrown out that library. And here we go again. I'm not surprised. We're now wumping up for war again. And it is, so that piece of work is a massive piece of work. It's 14 metres long, this submarine, and at the moment it's being stored at Shenton College. It's on display there in the history area without its follicle because it can't fit in. But I would love to show that work again. I think that works may not be political in themselves, but it depends on the context in which they're shown. So for instance, if that work was shown now and people were talking about protest or AUKUS or what's happening with the war, this kind of build up to war that our government seems to be working towards, that work has currency. So I think artworks in general may be made at a particular time, but depending on the context in which they're placed, they have new meanings occasionally.
Speak afresh. Well, just last night, a group of people who want to see Fremantle be determinedly nuclear free presented a petition to the mayor and the city council, encouraging them to do all that they can to achieve that outcome. I love the richness of your work. I'm thinking particularly of a very large piece that I think you were commissioned to put in the Supreme Court, the new David Malcolm Centre in Barrack Street, Perth. It's a wonderful piece. my memory is, it tells us something about the Derwill Yarragon.
It is. It's a journey of the river from the river mouth here at Fremantle right through to the Avon. And it goes along the river and sort of tells different stories about each part of the river. But I worked with Rick Verme, who's a Fremantle artist, and we worked together on there's five other levels in that building that have glass installations in them that use the painting behind them, but then have digital images put on top. And they also tell the story of the river, the invertebrates, the names of all the posts along the river, different aspects of the river journey.
Well, I mean, you talk about the submarine. You classify that as a sculpture, a symbol artwork, an installation.
Mm-hmm.
I think you've done installations about things.
Yes.
You paint. You do so many interesting things. Are you always looking for a different way to express yourself?
I'm always grateful for opportunities to express myself. And I think one of the best ones was the one that when I was asked to be the artist at Tilt, which is the Goolya Garup, the gallery at Heathcote. And they have a great program where they ask an artist to come and work over a year and then have an exhibition. And they can do it about whatever they like, as long as it refers in some ways to Heathcote. And so I was able to do installation, painting, some history stuff in that exhibition, which was fantastic. Such a great initiative.
You know, everyone learns their way through art. I had a great-grandfather and a grandfather, and indeed a father who painted watercolours principally, so they were always around me. And I think my grandfather, at least, was shocked when I showed an interest in Picasso at about that tender age of 17 and got my books out. I'm not sure whether he considered it was art or not. But then I discovered people like Dali and the whole surrealist stuff, and you turn up to the galleries in Paris where there's some just tremendous exhibitions of it. And it sort of blows me away.
I love the surrealists.
And then René Magritte. I think Kerry Stokes has in his collection the one where there's a window level and there's a chook standing there and there's a sort of a Tuscan scene behind. And there's an egg and the chook's looking at the egg. And I think, this is crazy, amazing stuff.
Well, we are very well versed in the male surrealists, as you say, and I think most people could name Dali, you know, a Dali work.
Yes.
However, there's some fantastic female surrealists as well, you know, Leonora Carrington, lots of them, Toyen, lots that we wish we saw more of.
Well, therein lies an issue.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about the submarine being stored somewhere. What happens to all the art? How do galleries handle this? And you have another life, so to speak, in history and curating.
Yeah.
I mean, how do we handle this challenge for the years ahead? Can we circulate art? I mean, I want to keep changing things in my own home just so I can see everything that's around.
Well, you know, I think if you grow up in a household with art, you certainly end up being a collector yourself, I think, and enjoying that. And I think what is one of the great things is to swap art with people and to keep on buying it, but either give it away or loan it to people. There's plenty of young people, you go to their houses and they've got lots of big walls or walls with no art on it because they can't afford to buy it a lot of the time. But if you can start something and start that love of having art around you, then it's almost, it's not an addiction, but it's a very healthy addiction to have, because you get to enjoy things and.
But what about the big, just public collections? Do they have obligations? I know they do bring stuff out and they have exhibitions that go back to this or that. They might bring out all the early West Australian painters and have an exhibition, but it's a hell of a challenge, isn't it, to keep it and look after it?
Yes, it is, and it should be something that we take care of as a society, that we keep on looking after those collections, because they hold our history, our cultural history, and as I said before, they can be used again and again and again to talk about issues, to talk about our culture, our history, and especially in juxtaposition to things that are happening culturally. I mean, at the moment, I'm working with the Fremantle Art Collection to curate a little exhibition that's going to happen at the Fremantle Arts Centre in November called Desperate Measures, Art, Politics and Performance, Fremantle, 1977 to 1985.
What a period.
What a period. I mean, it should be way more stuff happening about this period because it was a very innovative, very creative period, and especially in Fremantle.
Well, tell us a bit more about what's going to happen. What have you found? Who's in it?
Okay, so the Fremantle Art Collection is a fabulous collection, and it's been going for many years now. And I think it should be more supported by the council. Andre Lipskin is the curator there, and he does a fantastic job. He has a couple of rooms at the Fremantle Arts Centre where he specifically puts up exhibitions about the history of Fremantle, bringing out things from the collection. So he might bring out Frank Norton to talk about the history of the ports. Or in this case, where you're looking at some of the artists in the 80s, one of them is Tony Jones, very well-known Fremantle artist, and he did a lot of sketches and paintings of the US nuclear ships that came into the port in the 80s, juxtaposing them with the yachts and all the smaller boats that people took out into the bay. And so that work in itself is not particularly political, but we're going to use it in a political context to talk about Project Iceberg, which was where a group of Fremantle, mainly Fremantle-based people, went out protesting against these nuclear ships and went onto the ships with banners and things like that. So we're using the art to talk about the history that we've had in Fremantle. So I think these collections are incredibly important. And another thing we've done is try and get some of the material from that period into the collection. Trish Coucher, for instance, has kindly donated that iconic poster with the three women were sitting in the 80s and it said, no sailors, no boats, no ships. And no ships, no bases, no sailors. And it was a very well-known T-shirt and poster. But because it was, people don't consider local history and contemporary history important, a lot of those posters and T-shirts have now disappeared, and so it's very valuable, this poster that she's donated to the collection. And that will be in the show.
Well, that's really interesting. And where is the force, if you like, for an exhibition like that? How does that generate? We're talking about what was happening in Fremantle 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, but there hasn't been enough done about it. And it's a way of celebrating the people that were part of our culture in Fremantle and influenced so many things. For instance, Miko O'Byrne came over here and he and his collaborator friend, Duncan Campbell, had this incredible impact on Fremantle. They moved into a big share house at 18 Ord Street with a whole lot of other people, including Ollie Black and Sarah McNamara and different people. And they created the agitprop theatre group or community group called Desperate Measures. And Desperate Measures just used to work in the street and bring people together. Then they had performances at Princess May Theatre there behind that, and they gave people confidence to be spontaneous, to look at political issues, but have fun. And then all those people that were in Desperate Measures went out into the world. It's incredible. Miko then helped start the Fly By Night Club with various people. He also helped start the Ethnic Music Centre of WA. He worked at WAIT as an activities officer. The people that worked with him went out into the world and started the Women's Circus. They were part of Circus Oz. They were looking at theatre and performance all across Australia. So, you know, this was like a little breeding ground here for activists, performers and theatre people.
I've interviewed people, some of them are quite well known around Frio, who are sort of around my age. They came down here and bought houses either alone or with new partners, and their parents, they always say, were aghast that they were coming down to this terrible place in Fremantle. You'd be lucky to get home at night if you were walking the street, or why would you do that? Very strange people live here. things of course change, but you wonder whether it's that sort of setting that gives rise to, you know, a Garrick mentality that produces art. Has Fremantle changed so much that we've lost that that creative urge? What do you think? Are you forlorn about where Fremantle stands in the art stakes these days?
I think that activist share house groups have, it's much harder for them to operate in Fremantle because of the rising rents and things like that. But they're still there, they're still around. Mm. There's lots of activist groups. I think that the art world has changed a little bit in Fremantle, whereby people have, you know, started to use their houses as studios more, and they've got older. So their practices have sort of settled down a bit, but they're still there. I mean, the recent Art Walk Frio, which I was part of, you know, there was three artist studios in our street, Wood Street, and 800 people went through. And so that was a joyful occasion, which really showed me that the arts are alive in Fremantle and supported by the local community, very supported, because people bought small paintings, they were very enthusiastic about the whole event, and I was very grateful to be involved, and I thought it was professionally done. So it was both spontaneous and I would say, like, with a lot of energy, but it was also inherently Fremantle.
It was, you know, I wasn't able to go to all of the three walks, but when I was out, you'd go into a house and you'd actually find yourself talking to people, like in a very refined art gallery space, who were interested in what was on show. They were interested in the whole topic, and you had conversations, you met the artist, you looked at what was around, you might have bought something small, and there was a wonderful sense of community came out of that. You think to yourself, well,
so yeah, the congratulations, community is still here.
Roz D'Souza for getting it all happening.
Yeah, and Roz did a great job. But that what she showed was that Fremantle spirit, Fremantle community is very strong still for the arts. So that hasn't changed, but the community aspect of circus is still here.
Yes, just.
Yeah, just. And you've still got these studios here at Old Customs House, just, which we're hanging on to. But we need to keep making these available. We need to keep making studios that are cheap and affordable for young artists, to keep them in Fremantle. Mm-hmm. We need to keep making opportunities for people to, not just to sell for the sake of selling, but to actually be educational and to have an open studio for the discussion, as you said, between people. Yeah.
So if you were the Empress of Arts for I'll give you a year, two if you need it.
God.
Are there things that are crying out to be done? I mean, everyone always picks on governments, national, state, local, for not doing enough and not putting enough money into the arts, perhaps not creating enough residencies. I'm not sure. Is it something that has to be driven by the art industry from the bottom up, or are governments to blame? Are there things that need to be done, Joe?
Oh, that's a big question, Michael.
I know.
I think that it all ages, stages of life as an artist, there needs to be support systems instigated by various people. So, you know, young artists need, on a personal level, I think, support from their family and friends. You know, and that is really about trying to understand what's happening, trying to give that support. Then there's the support of local government, which has always been a little bit haphazard because it depends on who's working in the council at the time and what knowledge of art that they have. So for instance, at the moment you've got some really great people working in council who have an extensive knowledge of the arts and I think who are providing lots of good opportunities, but it seems to be that the question of giving money to artists is always a really big one. Oh, we can't just give money to them, you know, because they'll just go and spend it on beer or something. Like, no, artists make, you know, with the tiniest amount of money, can do an incredible amount of work, and will always take that opportunity. We'll never squander that opportunity. But if it always comes with conditions, you must do this and that, and you must have a social outcome, and you must prove how you're helping the community, that just kills art. It kills the spontaneity, it kills the innovation. You really need to trust artists that have gone to art school, have some ideas. Wouldn't it be great to support them to push those ideas further without us being on their backs to make it, you know, something that we can understand, something that we can put in our KPIs? So my advice would just be, weirdly, give artists money. Just give them short-term grants, you know, short grants, doesn't have to be a lot of money. Or provide opportunities like residencies where artists can, they don't have to pay for the airfare. They can get somewhere, they can do the work there, they can come back and they can contribute to our society by what they make it from those residencies. What happens to their practice, their professional development? I think artists always give back. I don't know any super rich artists that have just taken the money and, you know, had an easy life. All the artists I know work hard, they give back as much as they can. And also artists are being asked all the time to give work for fundraising things. Oh, can you give us a little painting for this fundraising thing? Well, after you've been asked 10 times in a year, you don't have any little works left. And also you can't afford to do that. So
that's easily forgotten. Jo, when you look back, 40 years, you said, doing all of these things, yeah, and staying true to yourself through that period, what are some of the exhibitions, some of the works that you've made that you treasure, that you look at and just, for whatever reason, just...
think, did I make that?
did I make that? Who made that? Oh, my God, I did.
Oh, look, I think I've made a lot of terrible work, but I think I've made some beautiful work as well. And I do look back and think, wow, I hope that those people are looking after that painting.
Yes.
Because they are very precious, some of them. I think in my own lifetime, I've made the Gay Museum, which was a big curatorial exhibition at the museum in 2003. And that was an extraordinary opportunity. I mean, I initiated it, but I was supported by people to make it. And it was an experience of a lifetime to be able to curate an exhibition that you wanted to see, not for an audience or to make other people happy, but an exhibition that you thought needed to be seen and was interesting to you. So that, I think, was a pinnacle of that kind of part of my career. I would have loved to work in more museums, and I think that it would be great if museums opened up to artists more and provided opportunities for that to happen. And I think that the Maritime Museum at the moment is doing that with a group of people. Ghost River was a really good exhibition that I made about 2005. I also really like the work I did at Tilt and the submarine works, the underwater works. I've done some beautiful work over the years. And the last exhibition I had, which was at the Art Collective of WA in Perth, I was really looking at works about the wheat belt and the lakes at the wheat belt, the salt lakes. And that had come from a residency that I'd been given through Spaced. And Spaced sends artists to regional areas to live and work for a period of 3 months over a couple of years. And you work with the community. But you also, of course, develop your own work on top of that. And that's what happened with that Lake Grace residency. So I was brought up in Lake Grace, and then 50 years later...
You returned.
I returned. It was absolutely a fantastic experience. And I worked with the community. I loved that experience. I worked with an Aboriginal artist, Andrea Williams, to talk about the the long lost Aboriginal history of Lake Grace. And that exhibition went into the art gallery, which was wonderful last year. We had a good exhibition there called Rural Utopias. But from that, myself, the work has developed into these kind of very simple, glowing works about the Salt Lakes. And I never expected it to go in that direction, but that's where I am at the moment.
And what's next?
Well, I'm still working on this exhibition for Fremantle Arts Centre, which I think will be politically very interesting.
When does that open?
On the 8th of November, Friday night.
Wonderful. And beyond that?
Beyond that, I'm just taking it one step at a time and seeing where the paintings lead me at the moment.
Must be time for a gap year. And what would you say to the young 17-year-old who you happened upon standing down at the inner harbour watching the boats come in and striking up a conversation with her, and you say, what are your plans? She says, I'd like to be an artist.
Oh.
Would you push her in? Would you take her
I would say, well, it's going to be bloody hard at times, but the main thing to do is just persevere and enjoy it, enjoy the ride, because I never realised it would be so up and down, I think, as a young person. My father always used to say to me, well, if you're going to be an artist, you're going to have a rod of steel in your back, you know, a flexible rod of steel. And I never really knew what he meant. But I do understand that now, that, you know, there's times when you really lose faith in yourself and nobody buys the work and you just think, where am I going to store this work? I'm going to have to destroy it or paint over it or you know, you can see other people kind of going off on their careers. But then there's moments when you're painting and something happens and you paint something beautiful and you just think, wow, I'm in the right place at the right time. I'm meant to be doing this. Let's just keep going.
That sounds a little bit like my golf. Play a terrible round, but the putt goes in from a long distance on the last hole. I come back next week. But golfers, there's lots of them, they're very supportive of each other. They admire their good shots. They secretly, perhaps, please when they hit a bad one and don't win the day. But I have the really strong impression that the arts community is a good size and it's very supportive. And is that your experience over the years?
Yes, I think so, yeah. I think the art world in Perth has been a solace, you know. There's always someone there to talk to who understands what's going on. You know, there's a lot of, I think, complaints behind the scenes about not being supported enough, or, you know, there's always complaints. But basically people do support each other, often swap works with each other. There's been some fantastic older members of the community who are always generous, always supportive and mentoring younger artists. You know, Tony Jones is one of them, Evelyn Kotai is another. And so I guess my aim is to be one of those people, to give back to younger artists when I can. And just to keep going as long as I can, because I think it's a victory to be an artist. I mean, especially women that have children and male artists that have children as well. To have children means that your time is taken away. And really, as a visual artist, you need time. You have to have time to almost do nothing or tinker or let your creativity happen. You can't just turn it on like a tap. And I think that's the main thing that we always think about is, how can I have time? How can I work to make money to pay the rent? But how can I make time for myself? So if, for instance, I've never had a full-time job, I've always had to say, I can only work part-time. And that's been a big issue, you know, trying to survive. But at the same time, it's meant that I have been able to continue my work. And I think as soon as you stop that, giving yourself that time, it's very difficult to continue or pick up from where you left off.
I met a young theoretical mathematician a few years ago. I was having a conversation about his work just yesterday. A bit like an artist, he needs to wander he lives in England, an English field, I think, waiting for an idea just to arrive. Can you get your ideas anywhere? Obviously, you can go to Dumbleyung, or where they've got nice big salt lakes, or a little bit further on to Lake Grace, and you've got all of that, and it sounds like it's worked for you. Does living in Fremantle create ideas? Does place matter in all of this?
I think place matters a lot. I think place can be somewhere where you are at the moment, like Fremantle, which I love living here. But also place can be in your mind. It can be a place from the past that comes back and haunts you. It can be a place that is an imaginary place. For instance, for many years I did work about underwater worlds, and it was me imagining, or snorkeling and being in those places, but also imagining them as a place where things happened, and things do happen in that underwater world. You know, people commit suicide by throwing themselves into rivers, and boats sink, and towns are flooded, and there's all kinds of things happen under the water. Invertebrates live there, you know, so it is both an imaginary place and a real place.
Submarines.
Back to the submarines. I think that the themes in my life just keep on circling, and one of them is submarines, the underwater world. One of them is activism, you know, anti-war. I've always been very interested in Egypt, Israel, Palestine, Jordan, that whole area. I went there, the first place I ever traveled was to Egypt, and I worked on a kibbutz in Israel. So those kind of cultures have also been very influential in the way I think about all kinds of things.
Jo Derbyshire, it's been lovely speaking with you. People who listen to this, who then look at your paintings and say, how can I get one of those? They should go onto your website.
My website's frozen.
It's frozen.
They should go onto the Art Collective WA website.
And get in touch with you. Thanks for meeting today. It's been wonderful.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.